Okay, thank you very much. I'm still Louise, and I'm still a compulsive overeater. And thank you all for sharing. It's really important that we share our recovery and our journey with other people. It's how we start to make sense of our process, I think. One of the things I'm really clear about is that my job as a member of the fellowship is simply to mark my own path through the jungle. I'm blessed being one of the early people in Calgary, in a way, and right now I'm the old-timer in Calgary. That's it. There's some others behind me, but I'm it. I'm the longest consistent member. And what I always say is I remind them that my job is to take a machete and hack my path through the jungle. That's it. And be as well as I can in the process. Their job is to decide on their journey. And it may be the exact opposite direction of mine, and that's cool. Right? My job is simply to mark my journey through the jungle. And if they look at mine and say, oh God, she's nuts, I'm not going that way, wonderful for them. Because they then have a marker that they can go the other way from. And so I don't expect anybody to necessarily agree with me or to share my experience. I just know that it's my experience and it's valid for me. As I said to you the first night, I have a long time in Al-Anon. I have a master's in psychology. I work as a therapist. And those are all just part of who I am. I can't sort those out and divest myself of those elements of Louise. I also know that for me, and just for me, I can't be spiritually well if I'm not emotionally well. You know, I sponsor a woman. It's kind of funny, but I'm sort of the sponsor of last resort in Calgary. I sponsor way more old-timers than I do newcomers, and they usually come and ask me to sponsor them when they've been around for a long time and they're having trouble. And that, you know, that's cool. So this woman came to me about 3 months ago and asked me to sponsor her. And she does a form of meditation. She's retired and she does it 3 hours a day. Right? And she communes with God all the time. And she almost glows with holiness. It's really quite amazing. But she's totally nuts. Right? And that's her problem. The tape in her head is going all the time. She's not good enough, not thin enough, not smart enough, not fast enough, not young enough, not pretty enough. We all have those tapes. And she's struggling all the time to be at peace in her body and in her mind. And so, you know, it's that three-legged stool. If you get one way too long, you're still going to be out of balance. So I also think that recovery for each of us looks a little different, you know? We come at it in different ways. So I encourage you to think about your avenue to recovery and then to start trekking down that path. Don't ignore everything else, but start trekking down that path. I personally can't have a relationship with my higher power, a strong relationship with my higher power, when my self-respect is in the garbage. You know, when my self-image is totally negative, when I'm all tied up in a bunch of crap in my head, it's important for me to move forward. And so that's been a huge aha for me in the last couple of years. That, you know, because I used to sit at home and say, well, you may be recovering mentally and emotionally, but spiritually you're not doing so well. And what I've come to understand is that synchronicity of recovering mentally, emotionally, and spiritually at the same time. My abstinence has been strong, so I've been comfortable with that. So, that having been said, let's talk about step four. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I have to tell you that the first 6 months I was in program, I read those steps and I knew I would never do 4 through 9. Because I didn't need to, right? I didn't lie, cheat, or steal, or so I thought. And I wasn't a bad person. And so why would I need to take a moral inventory? And I was off at a retreat, and I all of a sudden realized that I had to do an inventory. Like that night, I had to start it. So I did like you did, and I took some time away from one of the sessions, and I started writing. And it was the beginning of the one of the most powerful lessons I've ever had. I came home from retreat, and my sponsor had been with me at that retreat, and it was the first retreat ever in Alberta. And we got back home, and she said to me a few days later, "How's that inventory of yours coming?" And I said, "Oh, it's okay." And a few days later, she asked me again. I said, "Yeah, well, I've been kind of busy." And a few days later, she asked me about it. I said, "You know, to tell you the truth." Now, for me to tell the truth was a big deal, because dishonesty is one of my core character defects. And so, to tell you the truth, whenever I start to write, my arm aches and my shoulder hurts. And it did, literally. You know, I just hurt. And so I can't, you know, I write 5 minutes and that's it, I'm done. And so I don't think I should do that right now. And she said, "Well, I think maybe you should do it for 5 minutes. And I said, "What?" Because I'm an all or nothing kind of girl, right? You're either going to sit down and write or you're not. And she said, "No, it's okay to do it in 5 minute increments, that's fine." And I went, "Oh." So I started, you know, the idea of planning out 5 minutes a day to write on this inventory, I had this vision that it would take forever. And so I did that for a few days, and then one day I wrote through the pain, which was emotional pain, and managed to get it down on paper. And so I actually did my first fifth step just somewhere around the time of my 6 month anniversary in program. And it was a tremendously freeing experience. And the reason it was so freeing for me was kind of multiple layers. One, I had told somebody all the deep, dark, dirty secrets I had. Not that there were many, you know, because I lived a pretty boring life. But I had told them, somebody, and she loved me anyways, right? She gave me a hug when she left my house. So I had to be okay. The second thing that fifth step gave me was the opportunity to grieve the death of my sister. And I know that's not a character defect, and I know that has nothing to do with the inventory. But you see, when I got into the program, the format that's in the big book made no sense to me. I didn't know what resentments meant, right? Intellectually, but I didn't know what they felt like. I couldn't identify my own. And so I just wrote my life story. And my truth is that when my sister died, she died in a car accident. She was 15. I was 19. She skipped school for the day and was rushing back into the city so she could pretend she had been at school so she could take the bus home, right? So the younger kids wouldn't know that she had skipped for the day. And the car she was in went out of control and hit a light standard and was totally demolished, and four of them were killed, two on the spot, and two died a few days later. And it was a tragedy. But I did a couple of things that I don't recommend you do. You know, the first thing I did, I ate. Right? I ate and I ate and I ate. People brought food, and I didn't want to offend them, so I ate. And that numbed my feelings. My dad got some tranquilizers from somewhere, and I took a few of those. I smoked 4 packs of cigarettes a day. Literally, 4 packs, that's 100 cigarettes. My sister died on a Friday afternoon, and she wasn't buried till Wednesday. And by Wednesday night, I couldn't breathe anymore, you know? 4 packs of cigarettes a day. And I got busy. One of my character defects is busyness. So I didn't cry. I was busy helping clean the house and make sure there was groceries around and sorting out food and writing on cards who sent flowers. And I got busy. As I said to you last night, my mother depends on me for a lot, and she always has. And so in that circumstance, she fell completely apart. And her solution was to send the rest of the kids away because she couldn't stand to have them around. And I said, no, I'll take care of them. So I got busy. And I took care of them. And, you know, I mean, I didn't live out there. I was married by that time. But what happened was that I pushed everything down. And then occasionally, in the weirdest circumstances, if I had a few drinks at a party, out would come all this grief, and I'd start crying and carrying on. And I said, where the heck did that come from? Oh, we have music in the background. Where did that feeling come from? What's that about? And it wasn't until I did my fifth step, and I kind of just put in this biography that, in this inventory, that my sister died. And what happened was, thank you, what happened was when I said those words, the grief came pouring out. And the gift of that was I no longer had to eat to keep that grief at bay. Now, I did my first inventory, my first step five, in December of 1980. And my sister died in November of 1969. So for all those years, I had kept it down. And I believe I used food to do it. And so in 1980, I gave that inventory away, and I cried for days about her death. And I felt free of it, that I could let it go. It's interesting to me in retrospect, we went, as I mentioned to you last night, we went down to Medicine Hat to visit with my in-laws. And driving down there, I felt really vulnerable and bare. And you know, I married into this family of size 5 blondes who took weight on pills and all had breast augmentation. And I walked in there and I felt naked having done that inventory. And I walked in and I sat down and I reached into a bowl of crisp, salty things and I started to eat. And within 2 days, I was palming sweet squares and cakes and cookies and shoving them in my pockets and eating them in the bathroom. Because I didn't have that protection anymore. So, sometimes what comes out for us in an inventory is not what we expect. I started in Al-Anon in 1983 and did another inventory and did it right away. And it was good inventory and it was helpful. And then a couple of years after that, I did another one and I gave that one away. And this one was more like the format that's in the big book. And it was really interesting to me. Some years after that, I was sitting in a meeting and they were talking about inventories and how important it is. And I always kind of felt smug when that came up, I have to tell you, because I'd done my first inventory when I was 6 months in. And what's your problem? Right? Why haven't you done yours? And what I finally realized was it actually took me 5 years to complete my inventory. I did it in 3 whacks. I did the first one, and the big thing that came out of there was the death of my sister and that grief. It's not what I focused on. It was one sentence in the inventory, but that was the emotional outlet. The second one, I focused on my dishonesty and my lying. It's not what I intended to focus on. That's just what came out because I was starting to learn about how much of a people pleaser I was. And the last one was really important for me because when I did my fifth step, I did it with a professional. And I'm sitting in her office, and I'm reading to her from my inventory, and she fell asleep. And she sat there softly snoring as I was sharing. And all of a sudden, I got that I'm not that bad. Okay? Just not that bad. In here, I had all this stuff. But if she fell asleep while she was listening to me, it couldn't be that dramatic. I have to tell you that I have heard dozens and dozens of inventories. And I really now do, with no disrespect intended, understand why the Catholic priests have the vow of confidentiality around the confessional. Are you ready? Do you want to know why the reason is? Because once you've heard three of them, you can't keep one straight from the other. We are just not that different. When, in my situation, because I've been blessed to hear inventories from so many people over so many years, I can't tell you honestly who I've heard that's given me an inventory. I really don't know. I never make a note of it. I don't write it down. Oh, Jane came and gave her step five today. Well, what do I care? No. I have it in my day planner. You know, Jane, 2 hours or 3 hours. But I can't remember. And what did you say? Sorry. Did I make sense when I answered you? Gee, I hope I didn't go to sleep. You know, other than that. Because we're not that different. We die of terminal uniqueness and we eat over the shame we carry for our behavior. But truly, we're not that different. Think about the kinds of things you've screwed up in your life, the character defects you carry. Most of us have a challenge with honesty, right? We people please, or we tell people what we think they want to hear, right? We say what we can to get out of trouble, right? We have a problem with honesty. The big book says fear is the corrosive thread that runs through all of our lives. Any person in this room not have a problem with fear? Of course we do. How it shows up is different, but it's there. It's for all of us. We all have resentments. Big book tells us that. Talks about problems with anger. Now, I've had people who say, I don't have any anger. Well, they don't. They eat it all down. Right? They put the plug in it. Well, yeah, okay, let's talk about having a problem with anger. Big book says we have sex problems. Well, you know, I know lots of people say, well, I don't have sex problems. I'm celibate. I'm single. I'm 40 and never had sex. Okay? I'll bet you got some sort of problems. Yeah. And it's not because you're single and celibate. It's because there's probably, with compulsive overeating, some issues around sex and sexual identity and sexual your sexual identity and your sexual behavior. That's just the way we are. I mean, I married my first date. Right? I didn't screw around with anybody. One of the first things I did, I've got to tell you, I have fond memories of Seattle. When I first moved out of the marital home and got single, I started fooling around with internet dating. And I met this guy. He was so much fun, and he really understood me, and he lived in Seattle. So I flew down one weekend. I didn't want him up there in case my kids kind of caught their mom having a fling, you know? So I flew down to Seattle, and I got to tell you, he sent me a picture. And in the picture, he looked like a grandpa. Like, you know, he looked like a man my age, white hair and so on. And he stepped around behind a pillar from SeaTac Airport, and my God, he looked tall, dark, and dangerous. You know, he's really tan and a head of white hair. Oh, my God. He was about 350 pounds, right? And I was probably 120 then. You know, I was pretty, no, 140. I was probably pretty thin. And I thought, oh, my God, over the internet, across an international border, I found a compulsive overeater. Sign me up, right? How lucky can you get? So we spent the weekend together, and I discovered that sex with a fat man is not much different than sex with a thin man. And I discovered that even though I'd been married for 30 years, people still did it the same when they weren't married. This was a good thing for me. And no offense to anybody, but men aren't all built proportionally. At least he wasn't. And much to my chagrin, my ex-husband was a better lover than he was. You know, whoops. Supposed to be wild and wicked, and it turned out not to be. The point I'm trying to make, if you haven't done your fourth and your fifth, is do it. You don't know what's going to come out of it, and you don't know what you're going to learn. And you may learn about catastrophic behaviors and ugly things, and you may not. You may have someone who hears your fifth step who goes to sleep while she's listening or he's listening. The important thing is to do them. Because once you're done, if you need to, you can go back and do them again. And so, for me, it took me 3 cracks of the fourth step before I got that clarity around my character defects and who I am. I'm an aggressive woman. They used to call me really tough at home. You know, my first meeting, I came in with a blue jean jacket, the collar turned up, and tight jeans, and short, really dark hair, and I was tough, right? Don't piss me off, because you don't want to be in my path. It's how I looked. I thought I looked pretty passive, you know, because I never would say boo to you, right? My husband, my children, the people I love best in the world, I yell and swear and scream at them, hit the kids on occasion. But I would never do that to you because I wanted you to like me. I didn't really care about them. They had to put up with me. And so I had to learn in this process of inventorying and being around you how I was a people pleaser. And I had to learn how I was abusive. I had to learn that I did many things that were not in my best interest. And I truthfully had to learn that my biggest character defects were of omission rather than commission. I denied my abilities. Right? How many of you are doing that? Working at jobs that you're less than, right? Doing things that you could be doing elsewise. Getting C's in school when you could have got A's because you're too busy eating or chasing around or doing something different. I learned that I was the best mother I thought I could be, but I wasn't the best mother I was capable of being. I learned that I had an interesting relationship with my mother, and it was because I kept expecting her to be something other than what she was. It was an ongoing process for me over that 5 years of inventory. I wrote in three big blasts. But it took me that long to get to the core of who I was. So that, there we go again with the music. So that I could get to the point that I could start to heal that stuff. So I could let, you know, the sunlight of the Spirit, as it says in the book, heal me. When we have wounds that we bury, you know, we cover them up with fat, and we cover them up with an armor of behavior or attitude. What happens is that we're playing with the people on the tape. We're playing with the computer who's keeps singing to us. What happens is, well, you know what happens. Take a steak and put it in a plastic bag and set it in the sunlight. What happens to it? Yeah, it gets really rotten and really stinky. And that's what happens to us. Right? We cover that up with fat. We cover that up with behavior. We cover that up from pushing away stuff. And we keep that all inside. And then we get abstinent and we start to expose some of that in our inventory. And when it's exposed, it can heal. Right? The sunlight can dry it out. The air around us can fix that problem if we let it. And that's the purpose of steps 4 through 9, is to open up those raw, oozing, sealed off, ripe parts of us to let them heal. And so, if you haven't done an inventory, I really encourage you to do one. I spent a lot of time and effort trying to find the right format. Anybody else in the room looked for the right format? You know, besides me, God knows there's lots of them out there. And with the internet, there's probably hundreds, right? You could spend forever looking for a format for inventory. And, gee, it's good. That's cool if you want to do that. But don't spend a lot of time. Just email me. I have dozens. I've collected them over the years. The important thing is not how you do it, it's that you do it. I believe really strongly that the only incorrectly done inventory is an undone inventory. Just write it so that you can have a look. And then pick somebody you trust to share it in step 5. Step 5, that admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of these wrongs. Our challenge is to see not only what we did, but what we didn't do. Where we are and where we might have been. One of the things I believe for me is that, you know, if you think of life as a path, I was on a path, and when the incest started, that path branched off a different direction. And my life went sideways for a long time. And then when I started dealing with my compulsive overeating and recovery in the program, and I started doing inventory, and then I got into therapy, it's like then my life turned back in the direction it was always supposed to be going. And I started to become who I was always meant to be. And, you know, my truth is I started doing that journey at 30 rather than at 2 or 3. But at least I'm doing it. And so you may not have that kind of tragic trauma in your past. You may have other kinds of trauma in your past. But whatever's there, it's now your time to work it through and let it go. But by a show of hands, I want to know how many of you have ever woken up and got out of bed or sat with your feet on the side of the bed, sat on the side of the bed with your feet on the floor and said, today is, fill in the date, and it's the day I'm going to screw up the rest of my life. No takers? No. Okay. See, I don't think that any of us make that choice. I think we take that action one little step at a time. Right? We kind of get waltzing down the path. And moment by moment, hour by hour, step by step, we get off track to what we could be. And our program and our steps are a way to bring us back on track. And so I encourage you to take a look at, if you're struggling with, have I done an inventory, when do I do it, should I do it, what format should I use, to think about, are you ready to get back on track? Are you ready to be what God means for you to be? So, like the pamphlet for this retreat said, trust God, clean house. There's 6 words. I haven't written down. Work with others. 7 words. Thank you. Right. This is the clean house part. Okay. Clean house. Figure out who you are and where you got off track. Now, the AA 12 and 12 says to look at the 7 deadly sins, and if that works for you, that's great. I couldn't make any sense of them when I first started doing inventories. I understand them today, but I can honestly say I don't identify with them. I know they're there, don't get me wrong. You know, I'm guilty of all of them. But that's not how I think, and that's not how I react. But I can talk about inventory in terms of the times I yelled at my kids, the times I've been less than honest. I can talk about inventory. The last inventory I did was trying to make myself aware of the times I had been less than I could be. Because that's also part of my character defects. It's playing small. It's taking less. It's being happy with less than necessary. You know, my ex-husband, I said last night, is functionally illiterate. He's drinking again after 15 years. He's back at 40 ounces a day. He's gambling pretty much daily. And he has a wife and 2 little children, a new wife and 2 little kids. And I feel really sorry for those kids because they'll never know him in the same way that my children knew their dad. They'll have a version of him. And the interesting thing is their version of that man will be quite different. Right, he's a lot older than he was when his first family was growing up, and he's drinking all the time, and he wasn't then. So even though they've got the same father, they have very different fathers. What I know is that that's their journey. My kids have their own stuff. I didn't get to be who I was or who I am today by accident. It was a pretty ordered path, if you will. You take somebody who's reasonably intelligent, who's the oldest and has some sense of responsibility and some sense of leadership, and you sexually abuse her and you put her in a violent home where her mother says, "You take care of it." And you're probably going to come out pretty much as I did. You know, a people-pleasing control freak who lied all the time. Right? When you look at your life, It is my personal belief that unless you got up one morning and said, today's the day I'm going to screw up the rest of my life, it's my personal belief that you've made choices and decisions along the way, minute little decisions that were perfectly logical to you at the time, but have determined where you are today. And so, if it's not working, put it in an inventory and tell somebody about it. And if it is working, put it in an inventory and tell somebody about it and celebrate it. Because that's the other piece. And we tend to ignore that. But you all have strengths. And one of the beauties of service, one of the beauties of recovery is we are given the opportunity to see that good piece to us. You know, that piece that can speak up, that can speak here, that can share in front of a crowd this size, that can do our part, as Mary Louise was talking about, organizing the retreat. You know, we've all got gifts. And if we stick around long enough, we'll find out what they are. You know, it's really quite amazing. One of my employees came to me the other day, and I said to you, I have 52 staff that report to me, and I'm the only Canadian-born person in the group. The rest of them are all from Asia. And I was talking to this gentleman, and he said to me, now remember I said the big thing about me is thou must not look stupid, right? And he said to me, he's a Chinese gentleman about my age, he's from Hong Kong, and he said, you know, I sent him out an email, and then I realized afterwards that what I was asking him in the email was totally ludicrous, like, duh, you know, one of those blonde moments. I used to be blonde, so I can say that. And so I sent him an email and apologized, right? And so I just don't forget it. And so he came in to see me and about something else, and I apologized again. And I said, you know, sometimes I've been in at that job about 6 months, and I said, sometimes I forget that it's only 6 months, and so I do things like that. You know, I forget I'm new, and those kinds of things are okay for a new person. It's a dumb thing to do. I misread his calendar totally. And he said, you know, Louise, we all thought that when you started, you just got thrown in and abandoned. And I said, what? And he said, our boss brought you in, introduced you, spent the day with you, and left. And you were left to sink or swim. And I said, oh, interesting. I never saw it that way at all. Right? And he said, yeah. He said, you know, we've had 7 assistant managers in 5 years. And we thought you were going to be the end of 7. You are the 7th. We thought we'd soon have an 8. And so we chatted about that, and he talked about how respected he felt as a member of the staff. And he said, it's so nice to work for someone who appreciates the work I do. He's a senior interpreter and senior translator. And to know that my contribution in the health region makes a difference. He said, that's really important to me. And I got to tell you, you know, 20 years ago, that would never have happened. Right? I'd have been so busy trying to not look stupid that I wouldn't have been able to ask for information or ask for advice or ask for, tell me about your culture. What do I need to know? What do we need to do together to go forward in a reasonable way? Right? And so that need that I had, that tape in my head that played that said, thou shalt not look stupid, when I shut that off and just went forward and did what I needed to do, I was able to do a much better job. And I was able to give them some of what they needed as staff members. That's a miracle, you know? Because 10 years ago, I would have been so busy not looking stupid that I'd have really, really burned myself out. Some people say that you can only do 1 4-step, one, you know, and then you do tenths after that. And I've heard that. And that's okay if that's your truth. It's not mine. And if that works for you, that's okay. I know people who have done inventories on topics, sex, communications, the ability to love. Anybody else in the room wonder at their ability to love? Yeah, I have. And I've wondered about my ability to be loved. You know, it's hard to be lovable when you're fat. And in my case, I didn't bath but once a month. And I was married, but it's hard to feel lovable when you're so empty inside. That too came out in my inventories. One of the things I do now, and you can call it a tenth, you can call it a fourth, I don't really care what you call it, is every year, sometime between Christmas and New Year's is when I shoot for, I sit down and I do a recap of the year. And I look at what I've worked on. I try to pick every year in that same exercise something I'm going to work on. So I may work on honesty or patience or, you know, it's about trying to immerse myself or steep myself in a character asset that I want. One year I worked on assertiveness, right? I will speak my truth. Don't do that one unless you're ready for lots of changes. Another year I worked on being present in the moment. And this year, I'm working on self-love. And just letting me be okay with me where I am and appreciating who I am, what I'm doing, what's going on. And so, when I do that year-end inventory, part of it's a review of my goals for the year, you know, because I have goals that I professionally or mentally, physically want to accomplish. And part of it is, I'll look at my personal journey around that one character asset that I've tried to claim for that year. And that works really well for me. And I may or may not share it with someone. Usually what happens now is I share the outcome. You know, I kind of get an aha, and I'll share that with somebody because it's important for me to share those insights. Not always, but most of the time. It's that... I think it contributes to that sense that people have of me as a duck. You know, and they can't see the action, so things just come easy, and they don't realize I've done all this work. I would encourage you to take a look at yourself. This is the 1st of February, 2nd of February today. It's early in this new year. Who are you today? What are you happy about? What do you think needs working on? What do you think you want to change for the end of the year? And write it down. That's not in the form of an inventory of what's wrong with you, but it's in the form of what can I do better? We all have things that we can enhance and fertilize and water so they can grow. And that too can be part of your inventory process. What can you do? What area can you grow in so that you can become more and become who you're meant to be? You know, they told me in the rooms when I walked in that I stopped growing at the time I started using. And so for me, that was probably about 8 or 9. And so I had lots of catching up to do. And I feel like I've done lots of catching up. It's really neat for me to be Louise today. Now, you're not all going to like me, and you don't all need to. Some of you are going to go home and say, oh, my God, that woman just wouldn't stop talking. My Lord, who the hell does she think she is? And that's good for you. I'm happy. Because I'm going to go home and go to bed, you know, go to sleep. And tell people what a good time I had at a beautiful setting with some wonderful people at a retreat in Seattle. And I'm still going to be okay with me. I promise you there will be two sentences I've said this weekend, for sure two, maybe more, that will come back to me and I'll say, oh, what was I thinking? What did I say that for? But it's done. Can't take it back, so, you know... I said to you Friday night, don't stew or make yourself upset or agitated over anything I've shared. Because it's just my experience. It's just my story. That's the only thing I'm an expert on, is what I've done and how it fits for me, how it feels for me. And in truth, you all know this too. How it feels today may not be how it feels Monday. Right? Because as we evolve and grow, we change. Hang on, I get my book. Step four is in how it works, and they give you a format, and they tell you how to look at it. And it's a great way to do the fourth step, and there's forms that you can do, and you fold over part of the page, and so on and so forth. And it says on page 67, notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. And so one of the things that has been really significant for me is to identify the things I'm afraid of. I used to be terrified of public speaking. And to tell you the truth, if you give me and say, Louise, you have to read a speech, I will be nauseous. Right? Just, oh, it terrifies me. Give me a PowerPoint that I can sort of speak around. I'm okay with that. Let me do this because I know the topic. Right? I'm okay. Tell me here's a speech. You have to make a speech. You know, like Toastmasters. Oh, God, I just want to die. So we all have fears. What are your fears? It's a wonderful topic for inventory. It's part of the inventory is laid out in the big book. And it's wonderful for us to just look at times. One of the things I realized, a few years ago, in Calgary in the morning, in the wintertime, you know, we get a fair bit of snow, and if you didn't hear, it's been with a wind chill, minus 50 where I live the past 3 days, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And that is too cold for man or beast, I have to tell you. Anyways, it's not normally that cold, and truly we don't live in igloos, but it's been that friggin' cold lately. It has been brutal. And so we've had to make adjustments, right? In how we dress, how we run our cars, all that good stuff. And that's what I see this inventory process is about, is about making adjustments. So every morning, one of the adjustments I had to make a few years ago, every morning, particularly in the winter, the radio disc jockeys say, oh, it's miserable out there, drive careful, the roads are bad, don't go out unless you have to. And this last 3 days, they've said that a lot. And make sure you got a blanket in the car and don't walk, you know, more than 10 seconds in the cold because your face freezes and, you know, carry winter, you know, all that stuff. You're supposed to take survival gear to drive to the office, I hate driving on snow or ice. It terrifies me. I've done it all my life, but it terrifies me. And so what I had to realize, I'd hear that, and then my stomach would clench, and I'd get nervous, and I'd get scared. And by the time I got the car, my palms are sweating. I'm just sick. I'm so scared. And then I'd drive to work and say, well, that wasn't that bad. What the heck were they talking about? And so what I realized that one of my character defects is taking words too literally, right? When they say it's bad out there, don't go out unless you have to, I kind of have it on a scale of 1 to 10, it's a 92, right? And that's how I react with my fear. Really what it is maybe a 3 or a 4. It's wintertime. Of course it's, I can see it in the wintertime in Calgary. Hello. Right? We get lots of snow. And so I had to learn that my fear was often caused by my head and how I interpreted things, the perception I had of them. Does that make sense? Yeah, has anybody else done that in the room? Am I alone in doing that? We make mountains out of molehills, and then we get afraid to climb the mountain, right? When really all God's asking us to do is go over the molehill. So if fear is a factor in your life, and the book says it's a factor for all of us, then I encourage you to do an inventory and to share it, because that's where the healing comes. It talks about in this page 69, it talks about sex problems. And we're going to talk about that tonight. And if you've not ever done a sexuality or body image workshop, I want to reassure you to begin with that this is not going to be a how-to. And it's not going to be a my life story is worse than your life story. Because I'll bet you my life story will beat yours. What we are going to talk about is how compulsive overeating and the realities of obesity have impacted our sexual identity, how it's affected our body image. You know, anybody feel comfortable in their own skin all of the time? Right? You know, and we talk about, you know, at retreats, when I was first in, we talked about the retreat leaders always say, well, go home and stand naked in front of a mirror and look in your eyes and say, I love you. And I'd say, not without your clothes on, honey. Right? It's really hard for me. That exercise in truth never did work for me. But what has worked is coming to understand that my body is a reflection of who I am, and it's just part of me. I'm guilty of that, you know, from the neck up syndrome that many of us have, right? My makeup was always done. My hair was done. It was usually greasy, but it was always done. And I put makeup on without washing my face, and God forbid I should brush my teeth. But I never looked at myself from the neck down. And so I had to learn to live in this body and learn that I'm more than just a brain and more than just a mind. I am a whole person. And that's been really significant for me. So that's what we're going to talk about tonight, being in our bodies. So I don't care about your cup size or how many sex partners you've had. Some of you are lucky or less lucky than others. I've had 3. Yeah, wasn't that great. So, you know, we're just not going to go there. So be comfortable, relax. We're going to be very, very clear about that. On page 72, it says the chapter's called Into Action, having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? And then they talk about the fifth step and sharing it. And I've heard people say, you know, I went and got a, in AA, I've heard them say, I went and got a drunk down in Skid Row and told him my inventory. And if that works for you, that's great. Didn't work for me. But whatever works, the important thing is that you do it. One of the things that it doesn't talk about in this book, and I think it's really important for us, is to write down somewhere, either as part of our inventory or separate from, the secrets we're carrying. How many of you are keeping secrets? You know, yeah, most of us have secrets. Maybe we had an affair, or we had a child out of wedlock, or we stole money, or we, you know, whatever your secrets are, I don't know, it doesn't really matter. Most of us have secrets. Write them down. Tell somebody. Because there again, you're not that different. I have never heard anybody in a fifth step say they killed their mother or other significant person in their life. And I've never heard anybody say that, well, no, I've heard that. Yeah, I guess that's it. I've never had anybody report to me that they committed murder. Now, by the way, I need to tell you that since I've been licensed as a therapist, when people ask me to hear their inventory, I always say to them, I'm happy to hear your inventory, but I have a licensing requirement that if you report child abuse to me, I have to report you, and I will. Because my responsibility to children and to my profession is more important than hearing your fifth step. Lots of people don't agree with me, and I respect that. That's your business. But that's my view of my professional ethics. And I always say, if you decide not to share your inventory with me, I won't make decisions about what you've done, but I need you to know that. And so then... And in truth, in the 20-some years I've been hearing inventories, I've never once had somebody tell me that they've abused a child. But, no, that's not true. I did once, many years ago. But I say that so that there is no confusion between that person and I. The sixth step... And we kind of split up 6 and 7 here. The sixth step, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. I think that, like the book says, I think our 12 and 12 says, that we are often ready for God to remove the negative parts, the results of those character defects. The embarrassment when I get caught lying. Mm-hmm. We don't necessarily want to give up the defects. And I think that for me, with that first inventory, I had a moment when I was entirely ready. I had a moment. And then I asked God to remove them, and then it took time. And for me, part of the challenge was I didn't know what being entirely anything meant. You know, that I'm too busy thinking all the time. I was never entirely ready for anything. And when I looked at the steps after the fact, as I was going through them, I thought it meant something big, right? Because I have this magical magnifying mind. And I thought it meant something big. And what I've come to understand today is it just means that for me, in that moment in time, I was entirely ready. And I continue to work the rest of the steps. And more will be revealed. And so other aspects of those character defects, other elements of those character defects, other ways that they manifest are revealed, and I can again be allowed to be ready to get rid of them, to let them go. It's just a process. One of the things I think that I did was I bulked up weight-wise to keep that festering part of me protected. It was like an armor that I wore. The other thing that my weight did for me is it kept me away from you. And I don't know if I can explain it so that it makes sense. But, you know, in our culture, we have accepted distances to stand apart from each other. So if you think about it, if you get on an elevator and there's you and a person of the opposite sex getting on the elevator, what do we tend to do? Two corners, right? You stand with your hands in front of you and you all of a sudden are fascinated with the numbers. You've never seen lights on an elevator, right? If you know them, you'll tend to stand closer depending on how well you know somebody. We know at the office that there are prescribed limits of distance between people. And how close you stand determines how comfortable you are with them. You know, until we get to the point that intimacy, physical intimacy, sexual intimacy, there is no distance between us. And what happens for me when I'm carrying my weight, when I'm heavy, is that me is kind of my heart. You know, it's right there. And the more weight I put on, the further I am standing away from you. Now, you don't see it because you're judging that societal or cultural interpersonal distance from my skin, right? So you're just seeing, oh, well, I'm 6 inches from her or a foot from her. That's appropriate from the office. But inside me, you're actually 18 inches away. Because I got this armor around the outside. I've got this padding. Now, I talk about my polar bear coat. When it's minus 50, you wear a polar bear coat. It's a huge faux fur-lined suede coat. It goes down to my knees, and it's bulky. And I'm really big in it. I'm cumbersome. I walk slow. It's heavy. And that's what my fat is like. It's that layer. And so people tend to stand just that little bit further away. And so it serves as a great distancing piece. And then you come into these rooms and we want to hug you. Right? And we suggest that you sit close in crowded little chairs like these. And we suggest that you bare your souls to us. And we wonder why people have trouble with abstinence. If part of the purpose of your weight is to keep people at a distance, stepping in there into their interpersonal space can be really uncomfortable for them. It was for me. So, again, we talked earlier today about looking at the purposes of your fat, what serves you in the eating and in carrying the weight, and take a look at that. Is that part of it for you? Is it part of that keeping people away? I think one of the things, too, that many of us do is we try to disappear in the fat. You know, people are embarrassed by obesity, and so they tend to look away, right? Especially if you're really large. And so even though you take up more space, we can become invisible. It's a terrible thing we do to each other and to ourselves in the process of this disease. Do you all have a big book? Yeah, good, good, good. Have you all read it? Yeah. Have you all highlighted it?
Yeah.
Oh, you might go through and highlight it. One of the things that I did is whenever I get struggling in my program, I buy a new big book and I go through it, and even just a little one, the first 164 pages, And I go through it and I circle all the musts. Right? It's a great way. I make a list of them. Right? Page such and such, you know, a little bit of the sentence, and here's the must. And the reason I do that is to force me to read the words. Because it's easy to kind of just, you know, eyes glaze and just kind of sort of read them without getting it, without paying attention to it. There's a lot of musts in the first part of the book. And if you read them and highlight them and pay attention to them, I guarantee that your life will be different. That's just how it is for us when we start to pay attention to what's there. I have my list, but I can't put my fingers on it right now. I have the first list I ever made of musts, and I've gone back and added to it. And what's interesting to me is the first time I did that, I missed about a dozen. Right? I'm actively reading for the word must, and I missed about a dozen that I found in subsequent times through. So, step six says, it's like one paragraph. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. In truth, I thank God from the bottom of my heart that it was over. Right? I'd done that damn fifth step and it was done. Taking this book down, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps, and we carefully read the first five proposals. We ask if we have omitted anything. For we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? Now, referral of the stones here refers back to the cornerstone that they talk about on page 47 in this big and the keystone on page 62. And so it's just a paragraph. It asks you to review, and are you ready? And some of us are and some of us are not, but I guarantee you, if you stick around, you will be. It says, if we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step six. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can He now take them all, everyone? If we still cling to something, we will not let go. We ask God to help us be willing. I read that book a dozen times before I saw that. We ask God to help us be willing to let go of it. So maybe if you're a passive person and a people pleaser, you won't let go of that right away. But you can ask God to help you be willing to let go of it. Right? Isn't that a novel concept? That was so reassuring when I read that. And then it goes on into step seven and the step seven prayer. What I know is that my character defects do not go away overnight. And I've come to discover that when they show up again with a vengeance, it's usually because I'm going into a new time of growth. And if I use dishonesty as an example, I never told the truth about anything when I walked into the doors of OA, not to anybody, because I wanted you to like me. So I always said what I thought you wanted to hear. And I never told my husband that I was disappointed in him, even though I was. I never said to the truth to the people I hung around with. You know, I never said, oh, I really don't like that dress on you. I never said, oh, I don't think that's too flat. Oh, yeah, it looks great. No, it doesn't make your butt look big at all. You know? And so I came in here, and after I did my fifth step, my sponsor asked me to promise that if I knowingly told a lie, I would go back and correct it. I got to tell you, that straightened up the dishonesty real quick. Yeah. I did not want to go back to you and say, gee, I just told you a lie, sorry. You know? I did it a couple of times, mostly to people in the program because I knew they'd understand. But I learned to stop telling lies. I learned to be quiet rather than to speak my perception of the truth. And my perception of the truth was what I thought you wanted me to hear, wanted me to say. I learned to stop telling tales in my head. So one of the things I would do is if I'd done something I thought you were unhappy with or would be unhappy with, I'd start thinking about all the reasons why I had done it and how to justify it, right? All the excuses. And they weren't true. I was just thinking them up, right? I was making them up. And then I'd get to you and I'd have a ready set of stories, you know, sentences to string together to explain why you were unhappy with me, why I'd done what I'd done. Interesting for me, I can catch it now. It doesn't happen very often, but I can tell when I'm going into some new growth because I'll be late for work, say, for example, and I'm driving and my mind goes to, well, I'm going to tell my boss I'm late because. Right? And I catch myself. Well, I had a flat tire. Somebody parked behind me in the parking lot, a tradesman, and I couldn't get out. There was traffic problems. There was, the roads were bad. You know, think of the list, right? The irony to me is my boss isn't in the same office as I am. She never knows, right? But in my head, I'm going to come up with a reason why I'm late. When the truth is, I'm just late, right? I slept in. I played with the dog too long. I got interested in the news on the CNN. I'm just late. And so that when that starts happening with any regularity, that's when I know there's something going on. Something I need to look at. Something I need to work. It's like God says, let's light this fire again and see if she pays attention. And so it might be that I'm feeling stressed out. It happened for me just in the last few weeks. Our department got split into two. And I don't know who my boss is. And I don't know if I'm going to get a secretary. And I feel like I got all this work and all the OA stuff is coming together and my life feels really out of control right now. And I was feeling really overwhelmed. And so I made a conscious choice to sleep late one day last week. I woke up with a headache. I took some Tylenol. I went back to bed. And I got up an hour later and I felt good and I'm driving to work. And I'm thinking, I'm going to tell them I had a flat. I'm going to tell them, must have been 2 weeks ago because it wasn't that cold. And so, okay, what's going on, Louise? What's that about? That's happened 3 days this week. And when I looked at it, I was feeling overwhelmed. God forbid I should feel stupid. So, and needing extra sleep because I was overwhelmed is really dumb, right? So, because it means I'm not a superstar. So I slept late, I made that choice, and then I want to find a way to justify it. So take a look at some of those core character defects that come up in your life, that come up over and over again. Do you know what they are? Do you all have at least one that come up over and over again? Yeah, most of us do. Yeah. No? Just shout out. What do you think they are? What are the most common ones in our rooms? What do you think?
Control.
Okay, I got control. I got what?
Procrastination.
Isolating. Not trusting. Compulsive overeating, obsessing, laziness, perfectionism, disorganized,
pride,
anger, complaining. Oh, complaining is a good one. I can do that really good. Ah, poor me. You wouldn't believe what they're doing now.
Resentment.
Anything else? How many of you have never heard one of those topics raised at a meeting? They're kind of the core of who we are, right? On that negative side. Right? So, what I want you to know is that steps 4 through 9 terrified me the first time I looked at them. And they absolutely made me afraid that, well, first of all, I didn't have to do them because I wasn't that bad. That was my dishonesty, right? My justification. And then when I did them, I thought I was the worst person ever. And I discovered I wasn't that either. I was just human. I had made choices and done things. One of the interesting things for me as a therapist is if I can get enough information about your family of origin, I can usually predict pretty accurately where you're going. And so, you know, we do work. That's kind of where my core practice lies is family of origin work with female recovering alcoholics. I won't work with anybody who has less than a year. And I prefer to work with people in AA because they have I know more about alcoholism than I do drug addiction. I don't very often work with people in OA. I do a bit, but not very often. And the reason for that is it's hard to be at a meeting with a client, right? And I've done it with a few people, but not often. Anyways, it's we all have our stuff, and your stuff is not that particularly different than my stuff or anybody else's stuff. And so, don't let your fear of the fourth step or the fifth step keep you from doing it. If you're not where you need to be, do it anyways. We have a rigid belief, and I agree with it, that you do the steps in order, and most of us feel that way. Many of us feel that way. Some have done it differently, and that's your business. And one thing I hear quite often in the rooms is you shouldn't do an inventory until you've got 1, 2, and 3, you know, settled. You know, you're a compulsive overeater, you came to believe God could restore you to sanity, and you've turned your major a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. What I heard at an AA meeting, I used to go to lots of open AA meetings, and this guy said he'd get 90 days and then he'd go out and binge, and he'd get 90 days and he'd go out and binge, and he'd get 90 days and go out and binge. And every time that happened, he'd come back and introduce himself as a newcomer, and he's a retread, and he's back for the first meeting. And finally, after this had happened half a dozen times, the sponsor said, "You can't introduce yourself as a newcomer anymore. You can put yourself up, hand up and say, 'Hi, I'm Earl and I'm an idiot,' but you can't say I'm a newcomer." And his sponsor said, "And start working on your fourth step." And my friend said, "But I obviously haven't got the first step down. I keep sliding." And he said, "I don't care, write your fourth step." And he started his fourth step, and from that day to this 21 years, he has not had a drink. He was drinking so he didn't have to do the fourth. So, are you eating and slipping and sliding so you don't have to get into those ugly steps, 4 through 9? Is that what you're doing? If you are, that's okay. You won't be the first one, and you won't be the last. But end it by writing an inventory and get it done. It says in the literature that an inventory is nothing more than a fact-finding process. And so I think that we get all caught up, I certainly did, that I'm listing my sins or I'm proving to the world what a piece of garbage I am. And all the inventory is about is finding out who you are. When I've got a noise in my car, I take it to a mechanic and I say, "Please diagnose the problem. Tell me how much it's going to cost to fix it and let me make a decision." With us, we have these character defects, we have these traits, we don't like them, we're not comfortable, so we eat. Instead of just taking a look at who we are and dealing with it. I promise you, if you do a 4 and 5, you're going to discover that you're not that different. And in that process, you get to join the human race and be one of us, rather than what that tape in your head is telling you, that you're terrible, you've committed unforgivable acts, and you should be ashamed. You're just a person. You have the same DNA that the rest of us do. You have the same opportunities and challenges as the rest of us do. And you chose at some place in your life to use food as a way to cope with life. Period. The only sadness in that is in choosing not to let go of the food as a coping mechanism. So do an inventory, write it out, share it with somebody. Get ready to let go of those defects and get on to step 7, 8, and 9. Because in that process is a freedom unlike any you've ever known. How many of you have done a fifth step? Quite a few of you, almost all. That's wonderful. What was your reaction to doing a fifth step? How many of you had immediate relief? Raise your hands, a few of you. How many of you felt scared as soon as it was done? Oh my God, a few of you, okay. How many of you felt nothing, thought you'd been cheated? A few of you, yeah. That's pretty common too. Oh, what's the big deal with this fifth step? I didn't feel nothing. Ugh. Yeah, that's pretty common too. How many of you left your fifth step and within a few days or a week remembered something that should have been on your inventory? Raise your hands nice and high. Yeah. Yeah, it's really common. When I'm hearing an inventory, I say to people, if you get home or any time in the next week or two you think of something, email me, phone me, write it down and mail it to me, because it's really common. We're so busy keeping the big stuff down, or what seems like the big stuff, that once we clear away that layer of scum, something else can pop up. And sometimes that something else was pretty big, but it's just, it's not that your inventory wasn't good, it's not that you weren't honest, it's not that you're a lousy person. It's just that your memory's cleared, now that stuff can come up. Sometimes doing an inventory is just no big deal. It's just another step you take to getting to where you want to go. And that's sad, I think, when that happens, but it's really not uncommon. And if you're a person who's running around looking for that high from doing that fifth step and you don't get it, sometimes we can start owning that we didn't do it right. And that's not true either. All it is that's your reaction. It's okay. The one thing I would like you to take home from this session is that you are not that different. You may be older or younger, fatter or thinner, American, Canadian, Washingtonian, Oregonian. You're just not that different. I work with people from around the world. And I got to tell you, in the Sikh faith, people born in India, there are fundamentalists. And there are people who aren't so rigid. Right? There are people with really strong beliefs and some who aren't so focused on them. In my circle of clients, there are people who have this going on or that going on, but they always have shades of both. You're just not that unique. You're probably not ever going to be president. I know I'm not going to be, right? I'm not American born, so I can't be. Other than that, you know, some of you are wealthy and some of you are poor, some of you are tall, some of you are thin, some of you are young, some of you are old. If you're young and you're lucky, you'll get old. Because the alternative's not so great. Huh? It just is. I have a dear friend in program who's in his 80s. And at 75, he decided to learn how to snowboard. Bless his heart. He went out with his teenage grandchildren and family kids, and they went out to the mountains for Christmas. And he came back, and he was sitting at the meeting, and literally, he was gray. I said, God, Bill, you look awful. Are you okay? He said, I snowboarded nonstop for 8 days. I am so tired, I can hardly breathe. I said, really? What were you doing that for? He said, well, I had to keep up with the kids. Bless his heart. He drives from Calgary to Vancouver and then down to Mexico every year. And the holidays in Mexico. And he hostels it and he mooches off friends in his work as he travels. And he stays down there for a few months and then he drives back. Last time he drove back and he said, well, I'm probably not going to live that long. So he drove back up through Texas and over to Florida and he did the panhandle and down to Miami and then up the coast. Into the Maritimes, up through New York. He went to the Statue of Liberty and so on. And it took him 6 months to get home. He got home, he had about a month, and then he turned around and went back to Mexico. And I said, well, how many more times do you think you're going to do that? And he said, God willing, I'll die somewhere on the road. And so what he taught me is that he's 80-something, and he's still doing what he wants to do. And so bless his heart. Isn't that wonderful? Wouldn't we all like to be like that? And so what would you like to do with your life, with your future, with what's left of you, of the time that we're given on earth? What we all know is nobody knows how much time we've got. So what would you like? What do you want them to put on your tombstone? That you were obsessed with food and eating? You know, here lies whatever. who was rigidly abstinent her whole life and had no fun with it? Right? Or do you want to live a life of richness and fullness? Do you want to live a life that's predicated on humor and fun and living? Yeah. Yeah. That's what we want. What's it going to take you to get there? Probably the first three steps. You can let go of the food and have some peace around that. And then steps 4 through 9. To let go of the character defects that are stopping you. To admit yourself, to allow you to admit yourself to the human race. And then an opportunity to build and grow from there. If you're really lucky, service for you will be like it was for me. It'll open a whole new door to the things I can do, the opportunities I can be given, the blessings I've been given over the years. All right, Kevin asked me to shut it down a few minutes early, so I've got 10 to 5. And we're stopping at 5. So what I'd like to do is throw it open for 10 minutes so that I can hear and we can hear some of your thoughts about steps 4, 5, and 6. What's your inventory been like? What's your sharing process been like? What have you learned? Okay? Thanks.